Welcome to Holy Fools and the Soul of Craftwork. I'm Jesse Joyner.
And I'm Steve Gross. Jesse, how are you? What's new in your world?
I'm good. I just got back from Montana, the big sky country, or country. Is that what it's called? The big sky? I think that's their motto.
What are you doing?
I was doing my juggling show. Yeah. Did you know that when you land in Billings, Montana, you land on a plateau? They call it the rims. And when you land there, you can see the entire city in a bowl beneath you. And because they're surrounded by these cliffs called the rims.
That's big sky country, Jesse. So how did the people treat you there? Were they down for some of your foolery?
Yeah. Montanans, they're good people. Hospitable, friendly.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. They took good care of me.
On our end, Jesse, we just spent a couple of weeks in Arizona on family vacation, listening to the coyotes howling in the gulch at night, frightening my small children, though no one was harmed. But that's probably enough get to know us blather that anyone needs. So let's get into the episode for today. Today's episode is a learning transfer podcast. So for you, our dozens of listeners, if you didn't get a chance to listen to the previous episode in which we interviewed the author of the great new book, Letters from the Mountain, good idea to pause and give that a listen first, because this episode is based on that one. So Jesse, what were some of your initial reactions to our interview with Ben Pelpant, the author of Letters from the Mountain?
He said, to be called means that God has anointed you to do the work. I love that quote. And I want to dig into that a little bit later in this episode here at the start. Yeah. What about you?
For me, there was a quote that stuck out. He said, Ben, in the interview, there's a beauty of working hard in obscurity and leaving the results up to the Lord. He mentioned that a number of times, and he invoked the image of the nameless boy in the Bible who offers up his small lunch of bread and fish to Christ, who uses it to feed the 5,000. It's a really cool image, and it's true and faithful. And it made me think about that idea of small scale soul craft, the way of working faithfully in obscurity, but with impact. And that's a lot of our vocation, is working hopefully faithfully, but without people seeing that work and the discipline. And then at the same time, expecting, hoping for, praying toward impact. And it brought to my mind, I remember I grew up and I worked for a long time and right in the border between Minnesota and North Dakota. And there's a city there, Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's like 100,000 people. And a fixture in the community is this small mom and pop candy shop called Widman's Candy. And they're chocolatiers, fourth generation. So they've been doing it for a long time, really small scale, but really high quality work. Widman's has been in business for over 100 years, which is a mind bender when you think how few retail shops last that long. Handcrafted work over a long period of time. And the key to their success isn't that they're flashy there, but they're just a consistent quality presence in that community. Even when I think at some point in the 80s, like the adult bookstore moved right next door. Well, Widman's didn't close up shop. They just continued to quietly do great work and to offer it up and to make the community better. And Widman's knows who they are. They know they're not trying to be Walmart. That's not their scale, where you come into Walmart and it's just rows and rows of candy and you're wandering them on your own. When you come into Widman's, you're getting quality service and this great product that's made with local potatoes, local chocolate. They have this thing called chocolate chippers. They're amazing. They'll change you. So if anyone wants to send us some swag from Grand Forks, from Widman's chocolate, that would be awesome. Chippers, you send them to Mountain View Church, Glenwood Springs, Colorado 81601. So those are great. But it's just a great expression of a group of people who work faithfully in obscurity. Relatively, they're not nationally known, but with impact, and it really blesses people. And for most of us, that's a lot of our work, working faithfully in obscurity, doing work that you feel called to and trying to do it to the best that you can to serve real people, even if you don't get recognition. So that came to my mind during the interview. The second thing he mentioned was the idea of patient urgency. So in the pursuit of craft mastery over time, there's a patient urgency working together. And I've used this illustration as a minister, and I know there's a certain group of sermon illustrations that have been overly flogged, like the starfish, the boy throwing the starfish back into the beach to save their life. Have you heard that, Jesse?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It works. Hey, the ones that work, they just keep, they keep pumping out. It's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is a usual suspect for an
Yeah, I
illustration.
saved
There's
that
another
one.
one. Yeah, it matters for this one. Another illustration that's often used, and I found out after a bit of study, is based on a real story, and it shows how long craft mastery takes. It's a patient urgency. It continues to develop, but it needs to be patient because it's lifelong. So there's an illustration that's used a lot. It's either of a concert pianist or a violinist, and I'll read it to you. So several years ago, this is about Itzhak Perlman, who's a world-renowned violinist. Have you heard of him?
Yes.
He's movie famous. I have never heard of him, but I know nothing about music. But anyways, he played a charity concert in Vienna. After one of his concerts, the guests were allowed to speak to Mr. Perlman and get his autograph. One man entered the roped-off area where Perlman was and stretched out his hand. The man said, "Mr. Perlman, you were phenomenal tonight. You were amazing, absolutely amazing." Perlman smiled and said, "Thank you." Then the man said, "All my life, I've had a love of the violin, and I have heard every great violinist, but I have never heard anyone play the violin as brilliantly as you did tonight." Perlman smiled and said nothing. The man continued, "You know, Mr. Perlman, I would give my whole life to be able to play the violin like you did tonight." Perlman smiled once more and said, "I have given my whole life." That's
It
great. It
is really
really
good.
does. And it really illustrates well the idea that craft mastery, it is a lifetime. So if a person is going to make a wise investment of their life to try to master a craft over a long period of time, it seems wise to consider the idea of callings. And even Ben talked about second callings. He didn't really start writing until he was in his 30s. So his interview brought up this subject of calling to the fore. And Jesse, you have done as much doctoral research on the topic of callings as anyone. So can you talk about that, both from the interview, but just from your research as well? What can we know about callings? If we're going to invest our life and we can only be good at a few things, our bandwidth is limited. So how do we think about calling?
Yeah. Well, that is one thing is already evident in what he said, having second callings and just making the word calling plural is, I think, an important detail in the study of callings, because research on callings and calling has shown that people have multiple callings across their entire lives and maybe multiple callings at once. And that's okay. It's not a singular linear track of I have one calling, I am to do this, and I'm going to do it from age 20 to age 80 or whatever. Callings are something that we all sense and make meaning out of in our vocational paths, and it's they weave in and out of each other and they stack on top of one another. I think that's a good point that he makes, even like having a second calling, if it's a say a second career or whatever. And then he said that he has a threefold test to know if something is a calling. He said, "Is there something inside you that compels you?" Then he said, "Do people close to you see it in you, the craft or the calling?" And then he said, "Do strangers see it in you?" And I like that. I like those three things. And that rings true for what I've found in the research as well. There's that intrinsic meaning that you find in something for it to be a calling. And then his first line, it has God anointed you to do the work, has God put it upon you to do this kind of thing, that God is this external summons. That's one of the lines in the research from Dick and Duffy. Those are kind of the two big names in calling research, in external summons. And for those of us of faith, that's God. But the whole idea of other people affirming it in us, both strangers and close associates, that's a really important aspect as well. And I think that's an important thing too, because some people can go through life thinking that they're great at something, but if there's never any external affirmation, it might not be a calling. And likely if everybody's telling you to do something, but you're not feeling that intrinsic calling yourself, like directly from God or deep in your heart for something that you love to do, then that might not be a calling either. It's those two elements need to go together, of the calling from God, feeling the intrinsic joy of the work, and being affirmed by people around you.
Yeah, that's important tension. That's great that you bring that up. The idea that you need to have an interest in it that wasn't planted there by somebody else's expectation of you.
Exactly.
Because if you don't have juggling on the brain or raising cattle on the brain or whatever you feel that calling is, then you can't manufacture that from the outside or even from compensation. But then that external piece, and his book is worth the price of the book just for that internal, external section he writes about how do you discern calling. Externally, are there people around you that can realize impact like that? What you're doing, it blesses me or it blesses somebody, or they're already doing that work and they can see it, at least in the raw in you, something that should be developed. Jesse, what else did you see as far as learning concepts?
Yeah. Connected to calling is if God has anointed you to do something, you are ideally either good at it a little bit or you have the capacity to be good at it. Like, that's why God calls you into something. He's given you gifts. And yep. So we want to steward those gifts. We want to work on those gifts and grow in those gifts. And one thing that Ben said that I think brings us together is he told the story of Flannery O'Connor. And somebody asked her, why do you write? And she said, because I'm good at it. And I don't see that as pride. It might come across at first as pride, but it's it's what is known as confident competence, you know, being skillfully competent at something and being confident that you have that. Those are actually the kind of people we want to learn from. I mean, nobody wants to learn under somebody that has no confident competence in what they do. So that's okay. It's knowing your gift and understanding that you have a responsibility to steward that gift in the service of others, which again is a mark of calling. And I put it this way. So Steve, if you needed surgery, would you want a surgeon who said at the consult, he was like, or he or she said, "Oh shucks, I'm not really a great surgeon."
Yes. Not on my not on my healthcare plan.
No.
That's actually who we could afford, but we don't want him. Yeah, you want somebody confident.
You want a surgeon who says, you're in good hands. That's the kind of surgeon I want. I don't want a falsely humble surgeon to kick the dirt and say, oh, I'm really not that great.
Yeah. Jesse, talk about your own calling. And early on, was there somebody who could recognize and did recognize in you giftings in the raw that also blessed them or other people? How was that confirmed?
Yeah, when I was in high school, some friends of mine had heard that I could juggle. I was kind of new to the school at the time. I moved around a lot as a kid, so I was only at this with this group of students for a year or two, and they found out that I could juggle. So one of the guys talked me into auditioning with him for the talent night at our high school. Like, they called it the variety show. So people would come. It's kind of like America's Got Talent high school level. So you got like someone playing the drums, someone saying poetry, someone singing a song. And then us jugglers, we come out and we auditioned. They accepted us into the show. And then the showtime came, and I had never really performed juggling before, at least not for any more than like five people. And I get up on this big stage and I start juggling with my friends, and they weren't that great. They thought juggling was fun and simple. To me, juggling was a joy and a love. I was really, really enamored with juggling up to that point in my life. And I practiced in private for, I don't know, hundreds of hours because I loved it so much. And I was really good. I was a lot better than these other guys that had roped me into it. So we get up on stage, they do some juggling tricks, and some of them are fumbling around and dropping, and it's fun. They're having fun. And then I do some of my tricks, and I pull out these machetes, and I start juggling machetes, and I pull out a 6-foot ladder, and I balance it on my face, and it just brings the house down, and everybody loves it. And I had never seen that happen before, to bring something that I was gifted with and take it to a stage and show it off to people. And then seeing people appreciate it and find joy in that, and the applause and the clapping. And that was all great. And it was a few days later that someone came to me that was in that audience. It was a young woman who was a few years older than me. She was like a junior or senior at the high school. She said, "Hey, I saw your show, and I work for this party company in town. They hired me and other entertainers to do like clowning and other entertainment shows for parties on the weekends. You gotta come work for us." And I was like, okay. And so they connected me to this woman that ran an entertainment company in our city that booked entertainers for birthday parties on the weekends. And hey, as a 10th grader, you know, I was like 15 years old or something, you know, making 30 bucks an hour, you know, dressing up as a clown for a birthday party, that was a lot more money than the minimum wage of $4 or $5 an hour was the going rate for us high school kids, and the work we could find flipping burgers or you know, lifeguarding or something. That was the beginning of my own story with my calling of juggling. And it was because somebody else saw it in me and invited me into a deeper way of doing it. But it didn't happen unless I put myself out there too. Like I put myself out there, but I put myself out there on the stage because some friends heard about what I did and they roped me into it. So I'm thankful for those friends.
Good example, Jesse. And also for anyone listening to this who wants to discern what might be the work that God has called you to do, created you to do, you're looking for a mutual affirmation. Not only do you have a desire and drive to do the work, it's interesting to you, but also other people like having you do that work and see value in you doing it.
Back to what Ben was talking about, he talked about faithfulness and obscurity. If I may, about my story again, I was, without knowing it, but looking back in hindsight, now what I was doing in my own room after school for a couple hours a night in seventh and eighth grade, I remember being on my knees in my bedroom, juggling 5 balls until I could figure out the pattern. And I would do it over and over again, and dropping and picking them back up and trying to do the pattern, reading the books from the library on juggling and doing whatever I could to get better. That was the obscurity of the privacy of my own bedroom that I put in all these hours of practice. And I did it because I loved juggling and I loved the challenge of trying to figure it out. I was not doing it of being a professional juggler that made a ton of money or something like that. That was not my ambition. My ambition at the moment was, I'm a middle school kid. I'm not a very cool kid. I don't have a lot of friends, but I've got my juggling.
And so, I could juggle them to the ground.
Yeah.
And you did.
And I don't have to compete with anybody. I was a smaller kid compared to my peers. I was on the younger end for my grade. So I didn't fit in on the basketball court or the football field. So I found this great thing with juggling because I can just compete with myself. And so Ben's theme of faithfulness and obscurity, that really does ring true for me. And he said, that's the boy with the fishes and loaves. The nameless boy was just faithful with what he had. What stood out to you as a learning takeaway with Ben?
Patient urgency. Ben mentioned it in his book. It is really what originally drew me to research craft learning. Craft work requires that you stick with it, you continue to improve work, but also that you have to get some things done. In order to learn, you have to learn by doing. You have to get some early iterations of your work done, complete, so that you can reflect on those early attempts and make it better. The morning when I was scheduled to defend my dissertation, I woke up and I went into the bathroom and I was going to shave and get ready. And my wife had written on the mirror in big white letters the following quote from Longfellow's poem, The Ladder of St. Augustine. But here's the quote that she wrote, and I also put it in my... I put it in my dissertation. The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight, but they, while their companions slept, were toiling upward in the night. And one of the things that I found with craft work approaches is that it lends itself to the idea of proximate doing, or that doing that advances towards some sort of ideal. You'll never arrive there, but you can continually pursue it. Proximate doing. In his book, Shop Classes, Soulcraft, philosopher and motorcycle mechanic Matthew Crawford, he writes about this kind of proximate doing. He calls it self-correcting oscillations, but it's the same concept. Like, to get better at something, you need to do and then evaluate that and then make refined oscillations or little tweaks to it. So that spoke to me. That's this idea of really, it's important to figure out what you might be called to. It's important to, with that sense of sweet spotting, to move forward and to get after getting better at it, to put it frankly. I think sometimes we might have an interest, but we don't pursue it that. And that brings us to our next step of learning challenge. We always want to include a foolish learning challenge that makes what we've been talking about real and measurable and hopefully helpful for our own growth, no matter what your vocation is. And like you said, we have multiple vocations or callings, it's plural. And so as we talk about these things, let's see where adding some intention might help you grow and become better at what you do or what you feel called to do. So Jesse, what comes to your mind as far as a foolish learning challenge in light of what we've been talking about?
Yeah, to answer your question, Ben challenged us in his interview. He said, if we want to be good writers, then we need to read a lot. It's plain and simple. Like the more you read, the more you see the great writing of other people, and you're filling your mind and your heart with that. And it inspires you and it teaches you and it helps you become a better writer. But he also said you need to strike a balance. Like you can't just write all the time because you're going to burn out. He said, or you're just going to write without being, filled and influenced with the good writing of others, which is what reading is. So I found that to be really helpful and challenging to think, but then I thought, how can that transfer to other lines of work? But if we transfer that to our different lines of work, if we're not a writer, say, like if you're a mechanic or if you're you make brooms for a living, mm-hmm. like I want to challenge you, whatever it is that your work is, fill your mind and your heart with consume the good product of other people in that line of work. Whatever that skill is, just fill your heart and mind with the good work of others at the same time as doing yours so that you can get better.
It sounds like a question of exposure, like purposeful exposure, which is humble to say, I'm already proficient at this, but I need to get better. And for that to happen, I have to be exposed to other people's work that's good or different than my own.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Go to the broom makers conference, the convention.
Broom maker. I don't know if that example probably is too accessible, but the idea, it really translates anywhere. If you're a baker and you want to get better at baking, you have to eat other people's food. If you're a juggler, if you're a preacher, if you're a carpenter, if you raise cattle, if you raise crops, really all those things, you can do what you've always done and you're probably going to be capped right there. Or you can consume the good work of others in a way that is open to learning from it. And, but not just consume, because you also have to produce, because he's talking about that balance. To be a good writer, you have to write and you also have to read.
Yeah. I was at a tattoo parlor recently, getting a big, eagle across my neck.
Sounds like you.
Yeah. It sounds like me. No, I was there because our two daughters, they got their ears pierced. That was a Christmas gift. So the local tattoo parlor had really good reviews for, it's like the guy that does the ear piercings. Everybody loves him in mm-hmm. town. And so we went to this guy. He had like certificates on his wall. And I think other people around the tattoo parlor did too. They were like, second prize at the for white and black tattoo at the Las Vegas tattoo convention in 2019 or whatever. Like they had these different awards and prizes, but what it told me is that these tattoo artists, they're going to the Las Vegas tattoo convention each year and they're entering into these contests. And I know when they're going to that convention, they're seeing all these other great tattoo artists and they're looking at their work and they're consuming the work of other great tattoo artists. And they're bringing it back to their little shop here in Richmond and they're doing great tattoo work, which by the way, Richmond, Virginia is known to be one of the highest tattoo parlor per capita, like in the nation, tattoo parlors per capita in the nation. We're one of the top three, I think, Richmond, Virginia. So there you go. It's a little tidbit.
How does a person know that?
I don't know. You hear about it. People brag about it. So
okay.
There you go.
No, that makes sense. Every field has that.
Yeah.
That expertise that you can learn from if you're open to consuming it and going after it and being teachable to it. What for you is an example of this?
Yeah. Even just doing this podcast with you, Steve, is great because we get to meet all these awesome people that are really brilliant and called to what they're doing. And it's humbling to me, like to learn from them.
As I thought about this, I'm inspired by other people that want to press into their craft, even if it isn't my own. And it gives me some fuel to do that work in obscurity.
Yes.
So that's, yeah. So when you see somebody, even if like the violin, I don't have any sort of desire to ever play the violin. And actually I don't even appreciate the violin that much. I don't know if that alienates any listeners, but I do. I'm fascinated by the idea that a person like Itzhak Perlman would practice for 9 hours a day. That's what it says. And like he prays through that practice. and he's a person with polio. And so he has his different limitations, but he's found a way to continually improve and to figure out how, what kind of voice does he have with the violin in the sense of the music that he contributes to the culture. So that's inspiring to me. And I think that's probably true of us studying and interviewing people that are pursuing craft mastery and thinking about how their own faith and work comes together. If we are offering up our loaves and our fish, like the little boy, to a great master. So that came to my mind. And my learning challenge would be proximate doing. That's my learning challenge for the listener. So for you, what work are you interested in? You might be drawn to, you might even be called to, but you've never really done it much. You've never really laid down practice reps to be able to then reflect on it. And you know, it's not going to be perfect and it shouldn't be, it won't be, but you can't learn without doing. That can be a temptation, is to be interested in something, but never actually get around to doing it, or never get around to writing that song, or you like to bake, but you never made a souffle. So it's going to be a flop, but it's proximate doing. So in order to get a round of doing or practice down on the table to learn from it, we have to do it. And so there's a friend of mine who talks about writing a song a lot, but he's never written it. And I just, pretty much every time I see him, I just say, write that song, man, write the song. Let's listen to it, write that song. And so for you and what you feel called to do, and whether you're paid for it or it's a different kind of vocation, what kind of urgency, what kind of proximate doing can you get after and put around a practice on the table to learn from? So what would that look like?
What would that look like for you, Steve?
Well, for example, Jesse, I think getting the cycle of proximate doing down is working on this podcast. So for us to continue to do episodes and learn and talk through it, which we do, I think that's important that we do talk it out and critique it and continue to do so, and talk to people that have been interviewed and learn what we can from that, from what experience they had, as well as people that listen to this. So if you do have any feedback, we would love for Jesse to get it. Indeed. So if you can find Jesse's house with a carrier pigeon, we would love to get your feedback.
I'm sorry, you're starting to get meta, Steve.
Very metacognitive. And that's very meta actually right now. Great. Yes, talking about the learning about the learning, or
learning about the learning. Yeah.
Yeah, the process too.
Inviting feedback on our learning podcast, on our learning podcast.
Again, if you have feedback on how we can improve, carrier pigeon, messenger pigeon, Jesse's house somewhere in Virginia in Richmond by a tattoo parlor, send it to him. I don't think we have a route otherwise, but also send us those chocolate chippers from Widman's Candy. That would be awesome.
Please. Me too.
Indeed. So embrace those learning challenges, and I would say be courageous, get some iterations going, try, fail, talk, fail, try, do better. We'll try that too.
On our next episode of Holy Fools, we will be meeting with veteran teacher Jake Bates. Jake is a friend of yours, Steve, is he not?
Yeah, totally. I met Jake some decades ago in Iowa at a camp. We were both counselors, and he has one of the most drastic calling stories I've ever heard, as God called Jake from being a drug dealer to a school teacher. That's not something you hear about often. So next time we'll dig into the craft of teaching. Until then, goodbye. This episode of The Soul of Craftwork is brought to you by the Roaring Fork Fellows Program. Are you a 19 through 29 year old interested in starting well in your career with a strong faith and work foundation? The Roaring Fork Fellows Program is a 9-month internship for young adults located between Aspen and Vail in the Roaring Fork Valley of Colorado. For more information, go to roaringforkfellows.com.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You can throw this in there if you want to, but you don't have to.
Sure.
Why did the blood cells go on strike?
Why did the blood cells go on strike? Union? I don't know.
They no longer wanted to labor in vain.
Nice. I thought it was going to be something about scabs, you know?
Ooh, that's scabs. A good one too. Oh, that's really good. I got to add that.
Money layers.
But the original was actually... My original was actually, why did the blood cells unionize? That's another way of asking it. Here, I'll ask it that way. Steve, why did the blood cells unionize?
I don't know.
Because they no longer wanted to labor in vain.
That's so good.
And what would you add to that, Steve?
I wouldn't. But if you like the jokes that Jesse tells, again, feedback via messenger pigeon to Richmond, Virginia. What street are you on?
Bagley? Westwood Avenue.
Westwood Avenue. You send that pigeon. Jesse's going to get that message and eat the pigeon, read the note.
What did those
make adjustments there too?
What did the unionized blood cells call the other blood cells that didn't join the union?
Scabs. I don't know.
You're right.
Confederates.
Scabs.
What? Scabs. That's good. Did you just make that up?
Well, you helped me with the scab one.
Totally.
Yeah. But yes, I made that one originally. Yeah.
This is the generativity.
Can we have bonus episodes of just dad jokes?
I like it.
We can call them bonus episodes.